Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the studios of KSFR and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. And today is the third week in our series on opera, and specifically the Santa Fe Opera. I would like to welcome Desiree Mays. She's an international storyteller and lecturer on opera, and she's the author of Opera Unveiled, the book that accompanies the Santa Fe Opera season every year, and she speaks nightly at the Santa Fe Opera during the opera season, which opens this year on the 27th of June. Welcome, Desiree.
Good morning, Marie Charlotte.
It's great to have you again. Now, this week's opera is Billy Budd, and this is a 20th century opera. Tell us about it.
Billy Budd is by Benjamin Britten, who was actually a turning point in the history of opera in London in the 1940s, 1950s. The Santa Fe Opera presented his Peter Grimes here a few years ago. It was a big success. And this is an opera that follows that. It was premiered in London in 1951. Billy Budd deals with a specific time in history that we'll talk a little bit about, Men at Sea on a Man of War, the HMS Indomitable. And Britten and his partner, Peter Piers, this was a long-term, wonderful relationship between Peter Piers and Benjamin Britten. Peter Piers was a great tenor. There are many recordings of his out there still. One can hear you. There is even one with him singing the premiere of this opera. They collaborated together to work on this story. It came from a well-known short novella by Herman Melville, of course, Moby Dick fame. Herman Melville had spent a lot of time actually at sea himself in the South Seas. He enjoyed a world that was a world of men, and this opera is all male. There are no women in it at all. It's a ship at sea. And this was sort of a tradition, I suppose, that came from the very beginning of the story of Billy Budd. Billy Budd starts with Melville's short story, and then Benjamin Britten asked the great writer E.M. Forster, whom you know, I'm sure, for the books Passage to India and Howard's End. Forster was much older at this point, and Forster was a little disillusioned with life. He was living in Cambridge when he was contacted by the young and up-and-coming composer Benjamin Britten and asked if he would write the libretto for this opera. He was happy to do so. He wrote the very first lines, "I am an old man now, and looking back," which is the way that the opera is sort of showcased. It starts with Captain Vere, the captain of the HMS Indomitable, as an old man now, long retired, but looking back on the events of what happened on board his ship in 1797. And then at the very end of the opera, we return to the same scenario with a resolution, as we'll see.
Now, this is an opera with an incredible historical, well, literary lineage. I mean, it's written by Benjamin Britten, but the libretto was E.M. Forster and Eric Crozier, and based on the novel or novella by Herman Melville. It's quite a story, just that alone.
Just that in and of itself. And in fact, I would encourage people, if they have in their own libraries tucked away or any library, to check out Billy Budd and read it. Read the Melville. It's very interesting.
It's short.
It's a little book, and many of the lines in the libretto are line for line from the Melville story, which is very interesting. They've kept very close to that literary source. So in this case, there is a very strong literary source, and then it's brought into the libretto form by a wonderful British writer. Eric Crozier helped because Forster had never written a libretto per se. This was something new for him, and Crozier had a lot of experience in how to write a libretto, which is a very specific form of writing. There's a lot of limitations. The story, for instance, has to be linear. It has to go from A to B to C. There can't be a lot of little subplots or description, because opera can't deal with that.
And E.M. Forster, probably many people know, if they haven't read his books, also from the movies like A Room with a View and Howard's End.
Exactly. Yeah, great. And I think that voice is there. And I'm going to read to you a little bit later on from Melville, not from Forster. So we'll get to that.
So meanwhile, let's talk about the plot itself with Billy Budd. Now, this is set in a whole world of battleships and warships and things like that in the late 18th century.
Yes, it's 1797 when the maritime wars between Britain and France, the French Revolution has happened, the revolutionary government of France are fighting the British, and this all happens at sea on this one ship, the Man of War. This was a very difficult time for seamen for a number of reasons. First of all, many of them did not voluntarily sign up. Conditions on these ships were absolutely horrendous. The food was bad, not bad because they didn't like it, but literally bad. The conditions were really horrendous. They were treated very poorly, and they could go to sea and never come back. So the way these ships were manned was by a system called impressment. These were press gangs. The captain would get together a group of pretty tough men, send them ashore to the pubs or the bars, and anyone who was drunk might wake up finding himself at sea the following day on a battleship.
So they were actually kidnapped and made to work on battleships.
They were,
and it was called impressed. Impressment. But it was really kidnapping.
Yes, it was, and the government turned a blind eye to this because there was no way they were going to fill those ships with fighters, with seamen otherwise. So in this case, it's interesting at the very beginning of the opera, a boat has gone off from the warship to a merchantman called the Rights of Man, and the officer literally walks on board, tells the captain, "We're taking some of your men," and chooses three hearty-looking men, and takes them back to the HMS Indomitable. They have no choice. So
they've had to abandon the Rights of Man, which is ironic and or symbolic.
Yes, exactly. And you'll hear at the end of the first section I'd like to play, Billy says, "Farewell, farewell, Rights of Man."
Exactly.
And the officers freak out because here is this young man singing about the rights of man. And they're super sensitive about this. This is from Thomas Paine's incendiary pamphlet at the time of the revolution, because the mutiny has reared its ugly head in many of the ships in the ports, two particularly Spithead and Nore. In one of those mutinies, these are historical facts, the sailors really did have legitimate gripes, and that was mediated, and it was all conditions improved. In the other one, there was some political overtones, and 24 men were hung as a result of that mutiny. So the officers on the ship are a little touchy on the subject of mutiny, and someone who suddenly sings about the rights of man, they're frightened, they're nervous.
Well, one can imagine that if you're kidnapping a lot of people and putting them on ships to do things against their will, that there would be mutiny.
Absolutely, but they kept a tight control on these men. For the slightest misdemeanor, bumping into an officer could result in a flogging, and that happens very close to the beginning of the opera, where the young novice slips and falls, knocks into the bosun. The first time he's warned, the second time he slips into him, and he gets a lashing of 20 lashes. These were brutal. This young man can't walk, and the shame and the pain afterwards is one of the tragic parts of this opera. It was a way of the officers maintaining control, because the entire crew would be assembled on deck to witness these really barbaric floggings. So there wasn't a lot of mutiny. This kept a pretty tight control. In the very beginning of this opera, then, we see the men holy stoning the decks. So I said, what's holy stoning? It turns out holy stoning, we've all seen pictures of this in old movies, is where the men are on their hands and knees scrubbing the decks with a sort of a soft pumice stone that would scour and keep the decks clean. It did keep the decks clean, but it also kept the men at work when they weren't actually fighting. What to do with the men when they had downtime. And then a little boat comes to the big ship with three new recruits. So if we could, I'd like to play that first section. And this is in English, so you will be able to follow.
You may be able to understand.
Well, I think that the enunciation in this is good. You'll hear Claggett, who is the dark character in the opera. He interrogates Billy, the tenor, who is a young man. He's in his 20s. He's filled with an inner radiance. That's the words of Benjamin Britten used to describe Billy. Billy is one of those people we all meet rarely in life, sadly, who are just filled with an inner joy and happiness. And this is Billy. So you hear his interview when he comes on board with Claggett, and then his joy about being in his new job. He's going to be a foretop man. That means he's going to be right at the top of those tall riggings above the crow's nest, taking care of the sails on this big sailing ship, and his joy, and then his mention of the rights of man, totally innocently, because he is saying farewell to the ship he's just left, which is called the Rights of Man. So let's hear some of the beginning here. Oh, there's one other thing I should point out. The officers think this is a perfect recruit. You know, we couldn't have asked for better, and Claggett thinks it's great. But when he's asked, where is he from, Billy stutters. Billy's Achilles heel is he's got a terrible stutter, and when he's backed into a corner or he's really angry or something happens he can't deal with, he stutters. And they note, they said, he's perfect, but there's always some flaw in God's plan. The devil has one little mark, and in this case, it's the stutter. So let's hear...
And we hear some of that stuttering in the opera.
You hear the stuttering here, yeah, when he's asked. The Billy in this recording is Simon Keenlyside.
Your name, Billy Budd, sir. Your age, you know, sir. No, your trade, able seaman. Can you read? Oh, but I can sing. Never mind the singing. This was better. This was better. Yes, and it's welcome. Sir, in wind and limb. Oh, yes, sir.
And that's the opening of the opera Billy Budd by Benjamin Britten that's going to be presented at the Santa Fe Opera this summer. Actually, the opening night will be July 12th. So that's something really to look forward to this summer.
So let's talk about Billy Budd by Benjamin Britten, the opera by Benjamin Britten, the story by Herman Melville. You've mentioned that Billy Budd is a young, strong, handsome man filled with love and light. But then there are these other two characters, Veer and Claggart, who are very different.
So it makes it a very simple story, I suppose, if you want to take it at the simplest level. There's the beautiful character of Billy in the center, and then good and evil on either side. And it's a tussle between the two as to who it's not a matter of winning, as to what will happen, how they wrestle for his soul. Not just his soul, but his life, as it turns out. So maybe we'll talk first about Claggart. Claggart is a master at arms. He is on the ship. Everybody hates him. He is disliked by the men and by the officers. He is, as the master of arms, his job is to police the ship, so it's already an unpopular job. But there's a darkness about Claggart that is frightening, and he takes an instant dislike to Billy for no good reason. He calls him beauty, handsomeness. But there's something in Claggart that decides he has to destroy this boy. Perhaps it's his own dark feelings and leanings. It's not clear. Maybe I could read a little bit from the original, from Herman Melville's novel, when he talks about Claggart and who he is. He talks about Claggart in terms of envy. The lodgment of envy is in the heart, not the brain. No degree of intellect supplies a guarantee against it. If askance Claggart eyed the good looks, cheery health, and frank enjoyment of life in Billy Budd, it was because these happened to go along with a nature that, as Claggart magnetically felt, had in its simplicity never willed malice or experienced the reactionary bite of that serpent. To him, the spirit lodged within Billy, and looking out from his eyes as from windows, that ineffability, it was as much made the dimples that die in his dyed cheeks, suppled his joints, and danced in his yellow curls, and made him preeminently the handsome sailor. One person excepted, the master at arms was perhaps the only man on the ship intellectually capable of adequately appreciating the moral phenomenon presented in Billy Budd. And the insight but intensified his passion, which, assuming various secret forms within him, at times assumed that of a cynic disdain of innocence, to be nothing more than innocent. With no power to annul the elemental evil in himself, though readily enough he could hide it, apprehending the good, but powerless to be it, a nature like Claggart's, surcharged with energy as such natures almost invariably are, what recourse is left to it but to recoil upon itself, and like the scorpion for which the creator alone is responsible, act out to the end the part allotted to it? A sort of archaic English, actually, reading it now, isn't it? It sounds like it came from the 1800s. But that gives a sense of what Claggart is about. He has his own, we don't know if it's his own dark desires, but something about Billy triggers everything evil in this man, and his purpose becomes one of destruction. He is going to find a way to destroy Billy, to have him hung from the yardarm, which is actually what happens, of course. And the aria that explains this, it's a very introverted aria. It's very similar to the aria of Iago in Othello, both in Shakespeare and in Verdi, where the dark characters looks into himself and debates what can he do. The theme of fate is very much to the fore in this. Claggart believes it's fate. There's nothing he can do about it. The choice is made. He has to destroy Billy. Billy, too, comes to believe that. When he is sentenced, he says, Captain Veer had no choice. I have no choice but to go to death. It's all fate. And that is resolved at the end in a wonderful forgiveness again. But at this point, fate seems to be guiding the characters. Maybe we could play some of the aria of this dark character, the master at arms, Claggart, and it's sung on this recording by John Tomlinson.
Cruelness, all that I never encountered you. What choice remains to me? None. I'm doomed to annihilation. I'm vowed to your destruction. I will wipe you off the face of the earth. Of this tiny floating fragment of earth, of this ship where fortune has led you. First I will trouble your happiness. I will mutilate and silence the body where you dwell. It shall hang from the yard arm. It shall fall into the depths of the sea. And all shall be as if nothing had been. Oh, you cannot escape. Hate and envy, I'm stronger than love. So may it be, so may it be. Oh, bloody, oh, endless goodness, you are surely my part.
And that was part of Claggett's aria from the opera Billy Budd that will be presented at the Santa Fe Opera this summer. So I think you can hear in that the darkness, the wonderful, this singer, with the color of his tone that gives a sense of who Claggett is. He's his own worst enemy, but he is bent on destruction of Billy. And then Claggett is balanced on the other side by Captain Vere. Captain Vere comes from a good family, and he's a captain that the men love. Rare in those days.
Yeah.
They call him Starry Vere. So the men support and love him. So let me read.
And it's interesting. I mean, you said this before, but it's such an interesting. It's not good against evil, good being Billy Budd, but Billy Budd is pure light and innocence, and it's good against evil. These two people who are neither one of them is innocent.
No.
And they're, as you say, they're sort of like, I don't know, God and the devil or something.
Yes, and they also have to face their own truths in this opera. Claggett chooses to bring about Billy's death. And Vere makes a wrong decision, too. So in a sense, as you'll see, this opera, in terms of the moral dilemma, becomes Vere's drama, not Billy's. Captain Vere, and again a little from the original story by Herman Melville, Captain the Honourable Edward Fairfax Vere, to give his full title, was a bachelor of 40 or thereabouts, a sailor of distinction, even in a time prolific of renowned seamen. Though allied to the higher nobility, his advancement had not been altogether owing to influences connected with that circumstance. He had seen much service, been in various engagements, always acquitting himself as an officer mindful of the welfare of his men, but never tolerating an infraction of discipline. Thoroughly versed in the science of his profession, and intrepid to the verge of temerity, though never injudiciously so. Captain Vere, aside from his qualities as a sea officer, was an exceptional character. He had a marked leaning towards everything intellectual. He loved books, never going to sea without a newly replenished library, compact but of the best. The isolated leisure, in some cases so wearisome, falling at intervals to commanders, even during a war cruise, never was tedious to Captain Vere. So this man is someone the sailors look up to. And in the next section I'd like to play, we get a sense now of Vere's dilemma. Claggett has come to him and told him that there is mutiny on board. he has found a mutinous sailor. This whole thing has been a setup. He sent his spies to rifle through Billy's belongings. Then he sent the novice, remember, who was beaten so brutally, and he tells the novice, you have to go and tempt Billy, tell him to mutiny with these gold coins. And the novice doesn't want to do it. He said, no, we all love Billy, we can't do that. And Claggart says, you want to be beaten again? So, of course, the boy goes. So there's this setup that he's going to bring Billy down. When Captain Vere hears this, he is shocked. He doesn't believe it. He hasn't, in the opera, had a one-on-one meeting with Billy, but he's had very good reports of him. He knows how he's loved. And there has been a rumor on board that Billy was going to be promoted to the top four topmen, and he's very excited. So at this point in this next section here, Vere has heard the charge of mutiny against Billy, and he brings Billy in to talk to him about it. Billy comes in full of the joys of life, and he believes that he's going to be promoted. But Vere tells him that, fact, he is not going to be promoted. Something else is going on. So you'll hear a wonderful dialogue here between the captain, who believes in Billy's innocence but knows he's been accused, and the boy, who knows nothing of this yet. And they sort of interweave in a wonderful dialogue. There's another overlay in this particular section of who is Captain Vere that goes back, I think, to Melville. There's a real sense of a father-son relationship between Vere and Billy Budd. I think we read that into it because there's no direct sense of it in the opera. But in the original story, Herman Melville lost a son of 18 years, 18-year-old, to suicide. So that must have been a devastating incident for him. And I think some of that is in Vere as he looks at this young sailor who is his responsibility and whom he believes to be innocent. So let's hear a little of that dialogue, the song between Captain Vere and Billy at this point. And Captain Vere is sung by Philip Langridge and Billy by Simon Keenlyside.
Studied men and their ways, the mists are vanished. To see me. I knew it, I knew it, I knew I'd be called Captain of the Mizzen. Oh, the honor, and you telling me. I shouldn't speak so quick, but the talk's got a rush.
Would you lie to be Captain of the Mizzen, Billy Budd?
Yes, or to be your coxswain. I'd like that too. To be near you, I'd serve you well. Indeed, I would. You'd be safe with me. You could trust your boat to me. Couldn't find a better coxswain. That's to say, I'd look after you my best.
And I'd die for you.
So that's a section from Billy Budd, where Captain Vere and Billy Budd, the seaman, sing together. And this leads straight in then to the denunciation, the crisis of the action. This is the high point of the story that brings about the horrendous ending, where Captain Vere does not believe that Billy he's wrongly accused of mutiny. So he tells the master-at-arms, Claggett, that he has to accuse Billy to his face. So he brings Billy in, and Claggett, you'll hear this, a very evil, dark voice, he accuses Billy of mutiny. Billy is so appalled that he is literally speechless.
And there his fatal flaw comes in, which is
exactly.
His stammering.
Yes, exactly. It's a very Greek moment, yeah. I suppose, in the drama. He stammers. He's not able to defend himself. Vere lays a friendly hand on his shoulder, it says in the libretto. He says, take your time, Billy, it's all right. Billy can do nothing but stutter, and you hear this. And then suddenly he does the only thing available to him. He hits out at Claggett. He hits him in the head, and Claggett drops. It was a freak shot, so to speak. Claggett falls and dies. And Vere instantly recognizes the horror, the dimensions of what's going to happen next, because this young sailor has killed a superior officer. So let's hear that section of the denunciation of Claggett with Billy and Vere.
Master at arms and for topmen, I speak to you both. You stand before your commander as accuser and accused under the articles of war. Remember, both of you, the penalties of falsehood. Master at arms, stand there. Tell this man to his face what you have already told me.
William Bond, I accuse you of insubordination and disaffection.
So Captain Vere is asking for help from a higher source in this terrible moment of dilemma, the tragedy of when Billy strikes down the master-at-arms, Claggett.
Now, just as an aside here, talking about opera, is the bad guy always the bass?
I know that comes up a lot. Well, typically in the 20th century operas, there's the soprano and the tenor who gets the girl and the baritone who doesn't. There's always the conflict, especially in Verdi. You know, the baritone and the tenors are both fighting for the girl, and the tenor always gets her.
So you don't even have to know the plot. You just listen to the one with the higher voice gets the girl.
Yes, exactly.
That's weird.
It is. And then the bass roles are typically older characters or kings, or they're not always leading characters. Don Giovanni is an exception, perhaps. But then in the time of Mozart, it was different. Tenors were sort of non-events. Today we hear about tenors and sopranos, but in those days, coming out of the age of the castrati and women singing pants roles, tenors were not important. This is something that happened in the 20th century, where the tenor gets the girl and is the hero typically. And then, of course, we'll talk in another show perhaps about the different kinds of tenors. In a Wagnerian opera, you get a heroic tenor who has to have that heroic, magnificent ring to his voice. You get dramatic tenors and the different types of voices for different roles. But here, Billy is clearly, in this case, Billy the tenor, and the voice of evil is the bass. So
let's go on with the story.
So at this point, Vere is distraught, and his mask, in a way, is off for a few moments as the man realizes the implication of what's happened. But then his official visage returns, and he becomes a captain. He tells Billy to go into a side chamber, a cabin, and wait for him. And he calls what's called a drumhead court. This is a court martial where the officers at time of war at sea could make a decision about how to deal with the situation. Vere says he will give evidence, which he does. He doesn't embroider. He tells exactly what happened, that Billy struck Claggett, Claggett fell and died, and then leaves the officers to their deliberations. They are appalled. They know that Billy is not innocent, is innocent. And he isn't innocent. It technically, according to the Articles of War and everything to do with the law, he's guilty. He has struck a senior officer and killed him. But morally, this is not right. Billy is lightness, sweetness, inner radiance, the handsome sailor, and not to be wrong. So this is the dilemma from the rest of the opera. Now, at this point, the court-martial make their decision. Billy must hang from the yardarm at dawn. Vere then comes out of his official stance and he says to them, I will be the one to give Billy the news. And he goes towards the cabin where Billy is held and feels that he is responsible for killing an angel. He actually uses that term. This angel was sent to us and I must sacrifice him.
Why doesn't he save him?
Because he's an officer and duty comes before moral reasoning. And again, you know, I've heard singers argue this both ways. Should Vere have let him go? But in letting him go, he would have lost control of his ship. Or would he? The men would have been behind him in this situation, but in order to maintain that rigid control, and also according to the law, it was very clear cut. This had happened and there was no choice in terms of the sentence. Billy had to die. But that didn't mean that in his heart he knew that this was the wrong decision and morally it was wrong. So this is, let's play just that section where he tells his officers, Vere, that he will be the one to give Billy the news. It's followed by a series of extraordinary chords. Not much happens at this point. Vere goes to the cabin and goes inside, and we don't know what happens inside that cabin. Let's hear that section.
Messenger of death.
extraordinary series of 34 chords accompanies Vere as he walks to the cabin where Billy is held, opens the door, and disappears inside. These chords, scored for full orchestra, each different in sonority and pitch, are related to the notes that form a vast, harmonized F major arpeggio. They will be heard again when Billy sings in his final aria that he is strong. The mere chords appear to give him fortitude. This quiet orchestral interlude, set amid the violence of what has gone before, is a moment of profound beauty and truth, a moment beyond fate when the choices have been made. We are not told what happens in the interview, only in Melville's book, that Vere comes out looking shaken and Billy somehow seems to have gained strength from it. Melville writes that something of healing passed between Billy and Vere. The chords stand guard over an interview in which fate itself is overcome, as both men agree on some level to accept what has to be done.
Desiree May is reading from her book Opera Unveiled, and we're talking about the opera Billy Budd by Benjamin Britten and the original story by Herman Melville. And so interesting. That's such a great example of how the meaning and the music are so closely tied together.
Well, the music always tells the story. I think I always tell everyone who asks me about opera, know the story before you get there. It really helps. Otherwise, you're struggling with story, and those stories are crazy stories, some of them. This one is very direct. The music will tell you, once you know the story, you are open to the music, and this music really explains it. This is an absolute tour de force, playing 34 chords at a moment of high drama, because it leaves it open to the audience's imagination, our own sensibilities of what could have happened. It raises all these questions of moral responsibility versus duty and the law that have all gone before, and it buys you a little time to deal with what is going to happen, because we all know now we are going to have to, along with the crew, witness Billy's hanging.
And one of the amazing things about that is Billy's own reaction.
Yes, it is. In the next scene, Billy is bound between two cannon, and it's his last night, and he's not really fearful, but he's accepting whatever happened in that interview. He accepts, and this is part of the beauty, the handsomeness, the goodness of Billy, that's first stated by Claggett, who hates him, and then later by Vere, who loves him in a fatherly sense, that he is able to accept what is coming. He thinks about his friend who will come, his messmate who will bring him. It's rather like a last communion of wine and bread. It'll be a biscuit and a tot of rum, and how he is not afraid. There's a wonderful line at the end of the opera where he believes he sees in the distance a far shining sail. E.M. Forster believed this was the symbol of love, and that death would transcend life, and that Billy has come to this acceptance, which, if you think about it, is quite extraordinary in this young, rough sailor seaman whom everyone loves. He comes to this moment of truth and acceptance that's quite stunning in production.
And it's really something to bring home with you and contemplate.
Yeah, it is. And I think Britten and Peter Pears were both anti-war. They were conscientious objectors. They actually left Britten at the beginning of World War II and went to America, came here, went to California. And the British public did not like them for this. They were unhappy about it, naturally. So it's interesting that here he is writing an opera about a warship at sea, fighting a battle, killing people. There's a wonderful scene where they're in a sort of a mist, typical East Anglian mist, where the mist is over the sea and they can't see anything. So they can't fight the French. They can't see them. But at one point in the opera, the mist clears, and there's a fantastic orchestral scene where suddenly the whole crew comes to life and mans the cannons. One shot is fired at a Frenchman they see in the distance, but it falls short, they're too far away, and then the mist descends. And from that point on, we are all encased, audience and crew, the whole stage alike, in the moment of Billy's death, which is extraordinarily well done. The wonderful set that the Santa Fe Opera is doing, I'm so happy, is as it was originally planned. It's a sort of a cross-section of a man of war. The sides of the ship, it's a sort of cutaway, the sides of the ship are up against the side side of the stage, and you'll see the rigging climbing up into the top part of the theater, and we see the ship itself. That's where the action takes part. At the end, to a funeral march, the entire crew is assembled with the dawn to witness the hanging, and the articles of war, the sentence is read, and Billy looks at Vere and says, "Long live Starry Vere." An amazing line. This is the line of forgiveness. Billy has forgiven Vere for what is about to happen.
And the theme of forgiveness, amazingly enough, runs through really all five operas in the season.
It does. Every year when I'm given five operas, the five operas of the Santa Fe season to write or talk about, and I look for a connecting theme, a connecting thread. And this year it was so clear. The theme is the theme of forgiveness. And in so many different ways. Last week we heard it in The Marriage of Figaro. This is a different kind of forgiveness. This is an extraordinary magnanimous forgiveness of the condemned boy forgiving his captain and the crew for what is about to happen to him. We don't see the hanging, thank God. That's not part of the production.
Yeah, a little dangerous as an onstage visual.
but we sense it in the men who love Billy and who would have mutinied to save him. Billy said, "No, don't let the men mutiny from my behalf. This has to happen. What happened to Vere had to happen. What happened to me had to happen." But as he is hung, there's this extraordinary visceral growl that comes from the men, and it builds. They are now, like Billy, speechless, not stuttering, but they can't give words to their anger. So there's a roar of discontent. The officers instantly jump into their roles, and they order the men below decks. And because they are brainwashed to obey, they slowly go below decks as the opera ends. The very final scene, then, is again back with Captain Vere. So this sort of, again, suggests that this opera is about Vere's dilemma, where he looks back and he has suffered all these years. Did he do the right thing? And in the very final moments, I think he finds and believes in that greater godlike forgiveness that Billy forgave him with. Now he too can forgive. This is a fascinating piece. You come away leaving the theater with a sense of sadness, but still the transcendence, the joy of understanding the meaning of forgiveness in a unique setting. There's no male-female love in this opera. It's about men on board ship, men who are away from home and family for many years. It's about the comradeship of men, about the love of the men for one another and the respect for one another that they have. That's paramount in this piece, and it's very unusual and I think very special. And I think Benjamin Britten and Peter Pears really managed to make a major statement about that situation and about the need for acceptance and forgiveness, maybe in a much broader sense than just Billy Budd.
The opera is Billy Budd by Benjamin Britten. That's a lot of B's. And the tickets for the Santa Fe Opera can be found at santafeopera.org or by calling 986-5900 in 505. Or 1-800-280-4654. Desiree Mays is an international storyteller and lecturer on opera. She's the author of Opera Unveiled, which is the book that accompanies the Santa Fe Opera every year, and she speaks nightly at the Santa Fe Opera. Thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. Next week we'll talk about Handel's Radamisto.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santaferadiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the colors of jazz.